Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We have a scenario now where we have probably the largest concentration of economic power in a private actor in history, even greater than anything prior to the financial crisis, in terms of the number of assets that are either managed by BlackRock or directly influenced by its system. But yet the current rules wouldn't likely make BlackRock systemically important. The question then becomes, if there are financial entities that benefit from Fed intervention and they are putting into the economy cash-like instruments, should they then have regulatory parameters that are heightened, that are more akin to a bank? And this is a very controversial subject. And this is going to be a matter of continued debate, I think, particularly in light of the Fed's intervention in this market. This is going to be a matter of debate for quite a while now.
Today, we're going to discuss two of the most powerful monetary forces in the American economy. One that wears a public mantle, but it's owned privately, namely the Federal Reserve, and the other, the privately owned investment house called BlackRock. Together, these entities control trillions of dollars that float around our economy, and both hold extraordinary power to wield money cannons that have impacts on us all. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Our guests today are Drs. Ryan Clements and Robert Hockett, who will discuss two aspects of money management that pertain directly to Main Street interests in the form of investment vehicles, one focused on public investment and the other, exchange-traded funds, focused on private market mechanics that keep the Wall Street casinos operating. In the case of the Federal Reserve, which has taken historic steps of late to stabilize corporations, banks, hedge funds, and other large money sectors, there's been criticism that what they've been doing has been great for private companies, but inadequate for many Main Street interests, especially states and cities, which are facing huge budget deficits from the coronavirus pandemic. The Fed is coming under increased pressure to make significant changes to its current funding programs for these entities. And we'll talk with Dr. Bob Hockett about how the Fed goes about that process. The private company BlackRock, with about $7 trillion under its direct control, has been tasked by the Fed to bolster large sectors of the investor economy by purchasing a special category of market funds called ETFs, or exchange-traded funds. There is a clear conflict of interest in this arrangement, since, as a private company, BlackRock controls most of that enormous market itself, yet has been given the task to help stabilize it by the Fed. This overlap of private interests and public need presents another example of how the financial markets rule the roost over public interest. Our guest, Dr. Ryan Clements, is an expert on ETFs and discusses them in depth with Ellen later in the program. Ellen has just published a new article about BlackRock, which tackles the ETF matter and the enormous monetary influence this private company wields. Let's talk with her now.
Well, Ellen, as we pull back the curtain of monetary intrigue and surprises, this week you've exposed a 7-trillion-ton gorilla whose name most people don't know, but whose influence is clearly established in your latest article, Tell us about why BlackRock represents perhaps one of the most powerful influences in the country.
Well, as you mentioned, it's got $7 trillion under management. It's the world's largest asset manager, and most people don't even know. They've not only never heard of BlackRock, they don't even know what an asset manager is. And BlackRock's big business now is exchange-traded funds, and most people don't know what that is either, unless they're actually trading in them. And BlackRock has suddenly appeared and is now managing up to $1 trillion out of the $4.5 trillion that the Federal Reserve has made available now that it's partnering with the Treasury to set up these special purpose vehicles that allows the Fed to do with it what it's otherwise not allowed to do, which is to buy toxic assets, basically. And the reason they picked BlackRock, allegedly, was because BlackRock had already done the same thing after 2008 with the toxic mortgage-backed securities that were on the books of AIG and Bear Stearns. And these were called Maiden Lane, these facilities. So I think I discussed before about these 11 facilities that were set up. So supposedly, this is all made to look like it was the result of the current crisis. You know, it just came out of the blue that suddenly we had another collapse in the market because of a virus that nobody expected. But actually, the economy was slipping all the way, or particularly the banking system was in trouble all the way back to last summer. And the central bankers were already talking about an economic reset, that they had run out of tools. There was the meeting of central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in August. And there was, you know, different speakers, and they said that the central banks were out of ammunition. What they normally do to stimulate the economy is drop interest rates, and that's supposed to encourage people and companies to borrow, and then the new credit will get money into the economy, and that will stimulate the economy. But they were already down as far as they could go, and some European countries were already in negative interest rates. So that tool was pretty much gone. And they were still facing a recession, and were expecting more of a recession. So at this meeting, there were four BlackRock executives led by Philip Hildebrand, who was a former Swiss central banker. So three of the four were formerly central bankers, but they all now work for BlackRock. And they came out with this white paper, this proposal, that said that what they really needed to do was to expand their abilities by actually partnering with the Treasury and setting up this credit facility that would be a standing credit facility, but would only be used in the event of a crisis. So it would be a way to, it was a sort of form of helicopter money. But they didn't think that the Fed should be doing helicopter money directly, you know, showering the people with money, which is what the original meaning of helicopter money was. It would just be a way to funnel new money created by the Fed into the economy through the Treasury, which meant, you know, through Congress. And it would be administered by private technocrats or, you know, experts in the field. Well, so in March, the crisis happens, and suddenly we see these special purpose vehicles emerging that were called facilities, just like this credit facility. So these 11 credit facilities were created by the Treasury and the Fed, supposedly under the CARES Act, but you can be sure that Congress probably didn't have much to do with it. It was probably the Fed that's set it all up. It was a way for the Fed to buy toxic assets that they couldn't otherwise buy. And BlackRock, sure enough, was the independent expert that was put in charge of deciding who got the money, or, you know, where the credit risks were and so forth. BlackRock's own business, or their biggest moneymaker, is exchange-traded funds. And these are very popular now in the stock market. It's where they're very liquid, so you can buy and sell them any time of day. They are a basket of underlying things, like it could be, I mean, the relevant ones here are the corporate bonds. So a basket of corporate bonds that aren't liquid And you don't want to, like you as an investor, don't want to be getting in and out of particular bonds, and you don't know which ones to buy, et cetera. So you just buy the whole ETF, which would be basically you're buying the ETF of a particular market, like the S&P 500, for example, of corporate bonds. They've done very well, and it's the pension funds that are in them, and all the big funds use the ETFs, are highly invested in the ETFs, and I think individually you can buy them too, like with your 401k, et cetera. And they've gotten so popular because they're so liquid and you could get in and out of them. But the nature of them is that it's sort of a winner-take-all business, and BlackRock has this very elaborate, sophisticated computer program that determines risk. And it has $20 trillion globally under management, which is, you know, the size of the federal budget or the federal debt, or it's like a quarter of the size of the GDP of the entire world. I mean, it's absolutely massive. And nobody can compete with it. It's sort of like Facebook and Google, as our expert is going to say in this upcoming interview. So BlackRock's the winner. There are three leaders, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. But BlackRock is clearly out there in front. So the ETFs were sinking in March. It works really well when things are going up. But when things start to go down and the investors try to get out of the deal, then it's very hard for the ETF to sell the underlying bonds or whatever the ETF is made up of, because that's the whole point of it, is to turn something that's not liquid into something liquid or something you can trade very quickly. But then if you try to get out of it, then you've got to sell off those things, and if they're not so liquid, then you've got a problem. And as our expert will also explain in his very good interview, I thought he was very, I learned a lot myself on how these things work. So, in fact, it was BlackRock that needed to be bailed out. It was the ETFs that needed to be bailed out. And the very first thing BlackRock did when it got this job was to bail itself out. I mean, it bailed out the ETFs, but half of what it had the Federal Reserve buy were its own ETFs. So it bailed itself out, and as our expert, Professor Clements, will explain, if that hadn't happened, the market really could have collapsed because things are so interconnected. So the Fed makes a good case that they had to bail them out. They had to buy the ETFs. But if it's so important that the whole market can go down, if the ETFs go down, then they really should, and we the people have to bail them out, then they really should be regulated. But I think they should be more than that, because when we say regulated, what is typically meant is that they have to have a certain amount of capital, et cetera, to make sure they don't go bust. In other words, it's all about protecting the market, the stock market. But it looks to me like the way they need to be regulated is that they're squeezing everybody out who does not own some of the ETFs, or, you know, it's not a big pension fund. And they are making the decisions about, they vote the shares on all the stocks they own. They own a controlling interest in 90% of the companies in the S&P 500, and they're voting those shares. So, and they're voting against us, the people. So they always typically vote with management, which means they're going to vote down things that are, whatever initiatives about the environment and that kind of thing, or labor rights, that sort of thing. So it's a very discriminatory, it's supporting the financial market, and it's not supporting the consumer producer market where the rest of us live and work.
Surprise, right?
Yeah, it needs to be made a public utility in the sense that it needs to have a mandate to actually serve the public interest. If it's going to be so massive, and if it needs our support, if it needs the Federal Reserve to bail it out, so it's like one of the banks that are supposedly under the Fed's purview,
yeah.
then
There was an article that you quote in your article called Foxes in the Hen House, and it says, quoting here, that it's not classic capitalism that we're dealing with here, but rather state monopoly capitalism, where giant enterprises are regularly backstopped with, as you're saying, public funds. The boundaries between the state and financial oligarchy are virtually non-existent, which is, of course, the same lament and the same story we've been giving in a variety of different ways for the last several years. But it really seems to be intensified now as we see the markets really just being on the verge of collapsing from economic realities, and all of this public money that we're providing on in a variety of ways is propping up the market, but not the real productive economy.
So what we really need to do, looking on the positive side, is that now that it has been acknowledged that the Fed needs to, they're the only ones that can stimulate the economy and get new money out there, in particularly in situations like this, is that they need to do some real helicopter money where they're really dropping money on the people. So they could do it in the form of universal basic income. They could make zero interest loans to state and municipal governments, which is what our other expert, Bob Hockett, will be talking about. The municipal liquidity facility is definitely discriminating against state and local governments because there's a very high bar for what state and local governments qualify, and the interest rate is prohibitive, so nobody's really going to use it, whereas the banks can borrow for free now at the Fed's discount window. And so what we need is to set up our own public banks, and so that we do, state and local governments can also borrow free at the discount window.
Yeah, on the Fed lending programs, a recent study, just very recent, indicated that 97% of the qualifying states and municipalities would not benefit and could not benefit from the way the municipal liquidity facility is set up. The rates are high, there are penalty rates involved, and so, you know, what value is it to most of Main Street America? Not much. You know, the Fed can lend to its buddies on Wall Street, but apparently is very stingy when it comes to giving it to the people and where it's needed. Well, Ellen, your article has had several different titles to it. Which one is your favorite?
Oh, well, my last title was Meet BlackRock, the New Great Vampire Squid, and that was a takeoff of Matt Taibbi's calling Goldman Sachs the Great Vampire Squid because it had its tentacles into everything and was able to manipulate things. And as it turns out, the BlackRock is a principal controlling owner of Goldman Sachs, and it's obviously much bigger than Goldman Sachs. So it's a squid that can eat the little squids even.
I really appreciate the great research that you do to pull these connections together. Let's go on and have our conversations with Dr. Robert Hockett and Dr. Ryan Clements today's show.
All right. Great talking
Thank
to you,
you
as always.
In 2008, the Federal Reserve got deeply engaged with bailing out major financial institutions that were later to be classified as systemically important, to the tune of $29 trillion, which, by the way, was done without congressional oversight or input. It did so with little to no help for Main Street America, you might recall, and millions of people lost their homes and jobs. The Fed's response to the coronavirus financial fallout is different, however. And while the banks didn't create this crisis, they're still getting vastly superior financial support than Main Street. This is seen most clearly with states and municipalities, which are even more severely impacted in this current crisis than in 08 and 09. Today, we're pleased to have with us once again renowned economist and Cornell professor Dr. Robert Hockett to take a look at how the current Fed response has improved on its earlier crisis performance, but is still missing the mark in its program for relief of struggling local and state governments.
By far, the lion's share of the assistance is still going to those usual suspects, right? Those larger financial institutions of the kind that we saw being rescued in 08 and 09. And so the amount that's being sort of designated for or directed towards small businesses and cities and states is you know, relatively small compared to that total. On the other hand, of course, it's relatively large compared to 08 and 09 because there was none of it in 08 and 09. The other problem is that there are certain sort of terms or conditions that are attached to the community QE funding in particular, right? Well, the MLF or Municipal Liquidity Facility, but really, really out of place. They just don't make any sense given the purpose of this facility, right?
Basically, cities and states are too big to fail. The Fed, you would think, as our central bank, would really want to focus on that.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think an instructive way of sort of comparing the cities and states on the one hand to the large financial institutions that are also the sort of beneficiaries or objects of Fed largesse on the other hand is that they are simultaneously, you know, more too big to fail, so to speak, than those financial institutions are, and furthermore, less warranting of the kind of penalty rate language or the kind of coinsurance or deductibles that you would normally want to impose on a rescued TBTF financial institution on the other hand. So what I mean by that is, you know, our cities and states really are at this point, as we've talked about before, functioning as our de facto federal agencies in the national pandemic response, right? The current executive has been singularly ineffective, inattentive, and so what normally would have been dealt with by federal instrumentalities or federal agencies, because it is indeed a national pandemic, are being dealt with instead by city and state instrumentalities. They are our de facto federal agencies now. And they are, that means, what stands between us and mass death, right? I mean, hundreds of thousands of additional deaths. So in that sense, they're much more essential to our functioning, to our even living or surviving, than any financial institution has ever been. And in that sense, they're much more TBTF, so to speak, than are any financial institutions. But then on the other hand, by the same token, things are even more poignant because nobody can say in their right mind that the cities and states are responsible for the pandemic or that they're responsible for, again, the singular absenteeism of the federal executive this time around, right? I mean, how would states have stopped the pandemic from happening? Do they control our borders? Would they have sort of shut down all the incoming traffic from China or from Europe or from wherever? I mean, would any state or city have the jurisdiction required to mobilize across a sort of an interstate, cross-continental, nationwide pandemic response or testing and contact tracing program or to, you know, some sort of a program that would avoid states or cities having to compete with one another for short supplies of hospital equipment or respiratory ventilators or the like? Of course not. That's exactly why we have a federal government, because the federal government does that. So we can't blame states or cities for the pandemic, but we should also view them as not being proper targets of penalty rate charges or things like that as sort of the cost that the Fed would impose as a condition of the federal aid, right? After all, when a federal agency acts to solve or deal with a national problem, it's not like, you know, it borrows from the Fed and has to pay the Fed a bunch of interest or any other kind of, you know, fees or rates, let alone penalty rates. In so doing, it simply gets funded. It's a federal agency. It's federally funded to do a federal thing. So it seems to me, you know, insofar as the cities and states are acting as federal agencies, they should be funded as if they were federal agencies. And that means no rates, you know, no market rates, no penalty rates, nothing of the kind. It should be very liberal terms on which the Fed, I think, finances them, again, given the role that they're playing.
Is there a provision that would allow them to do that?
Well, yes and no. Basically, there are three possibilities here, right? One is just outright congressional appropriations to provide grant money to states and cities in the pandemic response. That is, of course, one of the subjects of the HEROES Act that will be being debated by Congress into early July. I think all of us, all of our listeners, and all of us who are part of this movement should, on the one hand, be pushing all of our contacts in Congress, anybody who, you know, might hear our voice in Congress, to ensure that the so-called HEROES Act, which will be a kind of sequel to the CARES Act, fully funds states and cities via just outright congressional appropriation. That would be the gold standard, so to speak. That would be the ideal. Barring that, or at least barring sufficient funds being appropriated in that way by the HEROES Act, the fallback is the Fed. And the Fed has sort of basically two routes by which it can sort of fulfill this particular function or sort of perform this task. One is the Section 14.2 authority, right? This is Section 14.2 of the Federal Reserve Act, which basically authorizes the Fed to purchase municipal paper, basically funding instruments that are issued by municipalities and states and the like, in an almost unrestricted manner. The only real sort of restriction that matters for these purposes is that it states that the authority extends to paper of 6-month maturity or less. That can look to be a significant constraint because 6-month paper is very short-term paper. That's about as liquid as it gets. On the other hand, it only kind of looks like a restriction because there's nothing that prevents the Fed from rolling that debt over indefinitely for as long as it takes. The other possibility, which is the one that's sort of most immediate just because the Fed is working on this score right now, is an ad hoc facility established under the Section 13.3 authority. That's the so-called discount window or exigent circumstances authority that the Fed often uses or certainly started using in a big way in 08 and 09. So essentially what that permits the Fed to do is it basically affords the Fed a great deal of discretion in developing sort of ad hoc facilities to sort of deal with very specific problems if they look to be truly systemic in character, right, sort of potentially cataclysmic in character, hence that phrase exigent circumstances. And then finally, thirdly, is kind of weird. It makes very little sense. It doesn't really make any sense, in fact, to be operating the MLF solely out of the New York Fed in Lower Manhattan. This is not meant in any way as a kind of, you know, slagging of the New York Fed. But it doesn't make sense, it seems to me, to administer a facility that's meant to essentially provide funding to every state and municipality across our continent-spanning republic, to house all of that in a relatively small-staffed institution in Lower Manhattan. So why would you still want to do this out of the New York Fed? Do it out of the regional Feds. Basically rediscover the 1913 mandate that made the Fed what it is, that basically gave us a distributed Fed or a federated Fed in the first place, and basically distribute the administration of the MLF and distribute the administration of the Main Street lending facilities too, while you're at it, over all of the regional Feds. And that would be the way to do it. So if we were to do that, right, if we were to eliminate all of the, you know, rate and rating requirements, you know, bond rating requirements and market rates and penalty rates first. Second, radically open up the eligibility criteria further, maybe even just eliminate them altogether and simply, at least in any kind of formalistic sense, and simply say, if you are a public sector instrumentality that is handling pandemic response over any number of people, you know, 25,000, 5,000, however small or large your township is, if it is handling pandemic response, you get federal funding to do it for as long as it takes. Just drop all of that kind of stuff. And then, again, thirdly, put the administration of it into, distribute that administration over all of the regional feds. Then I think the MLF would be it would be able to live up to what it's professed purpose is, you know, as articulated by Chairman Powell in multiple speeches, especially starting in late March.
That's Cornell Professor Dr. Robert Hockett.
My guest today is Ryan Clements, Assistant Professor and Chair in Business Law and Regulation at the University of Calgary Faculty of Law, and an expert on something that is pretty obscure to most of us, exchange-traded funds. So it's great to be speaking with you, Ryan.
Thank you for having me on, and I look forward to discussing the subject.
Great. So most people have never even heard of exchange-traded funds or a BlackRock unless they happen to be trading and that sort of thing. BlackRock is the world's largest manager of exchange-traded funds and the largest asset manager. Mm-hmm. So the reason all that's interesting to us is that BlackRock has suddenly been put in charge of administering what could amount to $1 trillion in Federal Reserve asset purchases, And the first thing it did was to buy its own exchange traded funds. So what I want to delve into and figure out is whether that was actually necessary to save the economy or whether it just saved BlackRock. And if the ETFs are so systemically important that we have to bail them out, whether it was a bailout first, and then if they're so systemically important that we have to support them, whether BlackRock shouldn't be regulated. Right now it's escaped every form of regulation. But starting at the beginning, could you explain to us what ETFs are and how they work and how they've grown to be so important in today's markets?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to do it. And I'm also, in addition, happy to discuss some of their involvement in the sell-off associated with the COVID pandemic. So exchange-traded funds are probably the most popular financial product innovation since the 2008 crisis. Effectively, an exchange-traded fund is an investment vehicle that provides an exposure to an underlying basket of assets, just like a mutual fund, but it has some very particular distinctions from a mutual fund. The most important is that it trades on the stock exchange, just like a stock does. And so when you purchase a mutual fund, you're getting a diversified basket exposure, but you're transacting directly with the mutual fund issuer. Therefore, you can purchase the basket of assets at their net asset value, and you can redeem them at their net asset value. Well, an exchange-traded fund acts a little bit differently, and this is part of what's made them so popular, is that they rely on the actions of financial intermediaries. So an exchange-traded fund originates when an asset manager like BlackRock, and BlackRock acquired the iShares group of exchange-traded funds in 2009 from Barclays. BlackRock is the largest issuer of exchange-traded funds. So an asset manager like BlackRock will enter into an agreement with one of these financial intermediaries called an authorized participant. They're normally large broker-dealers. And it will give that financial intermediary a contractual right to create and redeem these exchange-traded funds at their net asset value by basically exchanging a basket of assets that the exchange-traded fund issuer publishes. Now, once a creation of exchange-traded funds has been made, the financial intermediary sells them into the secondary market, and in the secondary market, that's where investors transact. So because there's two markets, basically, we have the trading of exchange-traded funds in the secondary market, and then we have the creation and the redemption of exchange-traded funds in what we call the primary market. There's a possibility for the prices to be dislocated, where you have the exchange-traded fund trading at a different price than the net asset value of what that exchange-traded fund represents. Now, in a normal market, these financial intermediaries have an incentive to perform what we call an arbitrage, where they can buy and sell in both markets at the same time to bring to align the prices together. But what we've seen is that when stressed markets come, there's been a series of times since exchange-traded funds started becoming popular where we've seen the prices of the trading of exchange-traded funds become dislocated from their net asset value, because these financial intermediaries don't have a legal obligation to perform this arbitrage. And so in a very stressed market, they can back away from the process, and then the exchange-traded funds, they start trading at a different value. And we saw this materially in the mid-March sell-off associated with the COVID pandemic, where you had almost 80% of every single investment-grade corporate credit ETF was trading at an all-time high discount. There was material discounts all across the market because these intermediaries weren't performing this arbitrage function.
So by discount, you mean they were trading at less than the value?
Yeah, so let's make it more concrete for your audience, okay? So you think exchange-traded fund versus a mutual fund. So if I want exposure to a basket of bonds, I can buy a mutual fund, where, and then when I transact with a mutual fund, I buy directly at the net asset value of the basket of bonds. I can also buy an exchange traded fund. I don't have to transact with the issuer directly. The benefit of me buying an exchange traded fund, I can get the same basket exposure as I can with that mutual fund, but I can purchase it intraday. I can buy it at any time using a discount brokerage. So there's the ability to provide heightened liquidity, and this ability has really generated their popularity. So let's stick with kind of the price dynamic here. I go into my discount brokerage. I go to buy without transacting at the end of day at net asset value in the mutual fund. I can buy at any time during the day the exact same exposure to a basket of bonds. I go to purchase that thing, and let's say it's trading at $10, but the basket of bonds is only worth $8. And so now where it became real challenging is in this last crisis, there was quite a few ETFs that were exposed to credit products and exposed to foreign securities that were trading at significant discounts. So let's say you're an investor and you own these things, you go to sell them, you're selling something for $8 that's actually worth $10. And so it can become very challenging. This isn't the only challenge with ETFs. Now, ETFs are also a tremendous benefit. You know, I can there's and we can get into why they've been so popular and all the benefits that they do provide. But in addition to the prices that investors transact in being potentially different than what those shares are actually worth, there's also an interconnectivity dynamic of how ETFs are actually being used, not just by retail investors, but more importantly, by institutions. And I think this kind of leads us into the question of the Fed intervention and the stability in the market, and we can get into that in detail as well.
So by institutions, you're talking about that's particularly relevant to us. It would be like pension funds. Would it include
state
and local governments? What kind of institutions?
Even mutual funds themselves. And so in the lead up to the crisis, there was some increasing evidence that mutual funds, pension funds, hedge funds, basically institutional asset managers were using ETFs because of their high liquidity, particularly fixed income ETFs, as cash substitutes, in the same way that they were in the lead up to the 2008 crisis. You saw the use of money market mutual funds, which were holding, you know, toxic asset-backed commercial paper and as cash substitutes as well. So where this interconnective piece comes, and interconnection isn't the only potential systemic risk. There's actually quite a few other ones that we can get into as well. But on the interconnection piece, what you have is two things I want to talk about. Number one, if an institution is using an ETF as a cash substitute, and they have a potential risk of a redemption of their own assets, their own securities that they've issued from their own investors, they then have to go out and sell the ETFs they hold on their balance sheet. Well, if those ETFs are trading at a significant discount to their net asset value, then that can impair their ability to meet their own redemption demands.
So by cash substitute, what you mean is mm-hmm. that the investors think that they can, if they put a dollar in, they can get a dollar out, just like with the money markets, right? So it's like you broke the buck with the money market.
Exactly. That's where one of the analogies are.
They committed to pay a certain amount?
Okay. No, that's the thing. It's unlike a money market mutual fund because there's not a commitment to redemption. It's more or less the liquidity management on the balance sheet of the institutional asset manager thinking that it has something that's worth a dollar that turns out to be worth less than a dollar when it goes to sell. Okay. Now, the other, though, I would say bigger issue than the cash is how the ETF links the underlying bond market. And this is where the Fed's intervention, I think, is most material, is because an ETF has, when this arbitrage function is working normally, there's a continual buying and selling of the ETF and the underlying bond market in response to dislocations to ensure that they are stable. But what there seems to be evidence of is that ETFs are potentially facilitating a bit of an amplification of market movements around periods of stress, and also attracting short-term directional traders because it's so easy to trade in these ETFs. And then what can happen is when there's an amplification in the movement of the ETFs, it can cause a proportional amplification of trading in the underlying market. And so then, that can turn itself into a feedback loop.
Okay. So when you say that traders are using them, so what you mean is that they see the market going down, and so they might jump in and short sell the ETFs in order to make them go down even further so they can buy them at the bottom?
Or yes, it can be. It
could be precipitating the market. When the market drops so much in March,
That's right.
The ETFs were instrumental in that because traders were messing with them. Is that correct?
It creates an unprecedented level of trading and acceleration. So one scholar has said the array of options in ETFs, so like put it into context, 2006 worldwide there were 728 ETFs. Roughly equivalent to $800 billion in assets via the ETFs. In 2019, a recent report showed that there was nearly 7,000 of them, representing over $6 trillion in assets, and now it's up to $7 trillion. The vast array of options, the high liquidity, allows people, and when I say options, I mean like there's ETFs that are sector-based, industry-based, asset class-based, economy-based, multi-economy-based. It amps up the speculation across a wider sector of potential bets, basically. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, when the trading happens in one, and there's a great example, you know, the CFA Institute just put out a paper right before the crisis talking about the effect on market stability of ETFs. When the Fed tapered off its quantitative easing program, there was a significant sell-off in fixed income ETFs, which ended up having a disproportionate effect on the yield spreads on the underlying bonds. And so you have this dynamic where traders have an access point to substantially increase the pace of their activity in speculative activities. And there's some concerns for those of us who study financial stability that basically the access point, the array of options, the pace of trading allow for a spike, an acceleration of potential market events. Now, there's counters to this, that not everyone thinks that. And there's lots of people that think that ETFs actually passed a bit of a stress test.
They passed the stress test because the Federal Reserve bailed them out.
Because the Fed, yeah.
That's what really interested me about your article of April 3rd. Mm-hmm. It was called What Have We Learned So Far About ETFs in the COVID-19 Crisis? I mean, that's what I suspected all along, and you really nailed that they didn't pass the stress test. I mean, here they have supposedly the Fed is not supposed to be dealing with ETFs. I mean, they're supposed to be dealing with banks. And
yes, your article as well, you know, got into these details. And you can see the evidence right now. Not only are they dealing in ETFs, but some of the purchases that are being managed by BlackRock, and it has included the purchase of high yield bonds too, high yield bond ETFs.
I've really poured into this now for a while, and I myself am having a little trouble following you. I mean, it seems to me the reason they get away with this, not that I want to color it, but the reason that things are happening at those high levels that we can see that we're not getting the benefit of it, and the rich are getting richer, but we don't know how they're doing it because it's so complicated,
so,
and they've made it so complicated.
Yes,
so
it's very opaque.
Really,
so let's try to get into the details. Let's try to kind of peel the onion here. And
okay.
So let's start with kind of the pro-Fed intervention dynamic using the ETFs as the vehicle to do that. Now, aside from the conflicts of interest of having BlackRock manage the purchases and the subsequent clear evidence that the majority of the purchased ETFs have been BlackRock's own shares, Here's kind of the justification, is that the ETFs, so when the sell-off happened, the bond markets froze. Credit markets became completely illiquid. They became very hard to transact in. Prices became very opaque, counterparties, volume, they froze.
So yeah. Credit markets, you mean loans, like loans bonds. To corporations,
yeah.
Right?
Bonds. Yeah, okay. Loans.
Go ahead.
Okay, so bond trading. Okay.
Yeah.
But the ETF trading spiked. But the ETF sell-off lent itself to discounts in the value of the ETFs relative to the bonds that they were supposedly tracking. Now, those in support of ETFs say ETFs performed a shock absorber function, meaning they were able to absorb the shock of this sell-off without the bonds that they represent having to be sold. And so they were able to get out ahead, act as basically a liquidity wrapper, perform a price discovery function without the bonds having to be sold. And so they prevented the feedback loop. But the problem with that, though, is that you could easily say that the Fed prevented the feedback loop, because the Fed's intervention then caused the surge back into the ETF market. The sell-off happened in the ETF. The sell-off didn't happen as much in the underlying bonds. And the Fed intervened, and that brought stability to it. So the concern is that if the Fed hadn't intervened, eventually the sell-off would have materialized in the underlying market, and that would have then affected all other types of assets too. Mutual funds would have had to fire sale the bonds. It could be redemption runs on mutual funds. And the fire sale on the bonds then triggers more selling in the ETFs, triggers more selling in the bonds. So the Fed stepped in, became basically a stabilizer of the bond market, became effectively a liquidity provider of last resort, in many ways even a market maker of last resort in stabilizing this market. But the counter, which you've already identified, is, well, what if the Fed didn't step in? You know, if the Fed didn't step in, then could have the ETFs actually facilitated a deeper, a more exaggerated sell-off because of a feedback loop, meaning the sell-off in the ETFs exacerbate the sell-off in the underlying bond market, which then gives feedback into the ETFs. And there just continues kind of a spiral, death spiral, if you will, in terms of selling on both sides.
That's exactly what happened in 1929. So we could have had a Great Depression.
And it's also what happened it happened in 87 too. These ETFs, in order for them to work, right, they rely on these firms, these large broker dealers, Goldman Sachs, these types of firms, to perform this market function. And if they stop performing the market function, if they stop performing the liquidity, then there's going to be problems. But the thing is they don't have a legal obligation to provide this function. They can back away from providing this function.
Along those lines, you had mentioned that what the Fed was buying were the existing ETFs. So it's not creating new ETFs, which means it's not creating new.
No. They're providing support.
So it's buying them from.
They
the
are
bank.
Buying corporate bonds, though. You know, some of the largest companies in America, Apple, et cetera, Microsoft, are having the bonds. So now this opens up a new rabbit hole of moral hazard. You know, moral hazard. Also, you know, is this the best use of funds? Are we able to trace this type of intervention to the workers and the small businesses? Like there's, you know, criticisms happening right now. Those who support the Fed intervention just say, well, it's needed for the entire system to function correctly, given all of these interconnected, highly complex parts, just like in 2008, everything we found out once we unwind it, like when you read the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, you realize like how complex but interconnected everything was. And seeing how after 2008, we've seen a similar interconnection and complexity, but in different instruments, but similar dynamics.
On the banks, I just wondered, could we in any sense call this also a bailout of the banks because they were holding these ETFs that we're losing value.
It's definitely an indirect support. Yeah, it's definitely a stabilizer. ETFs are actually the largest holders of bank stock across the board. So,
yeah.
And you know, it brings the question of, well, why an ETF? Why use the ETF as a vehicle for economic support and stability? And the simple answer is it is because the size of the ETF market and the representative ownership that these ETFs have in these underlying assets across the board. So, you know, you can purchase an ETF that can stabilize entire sectors, including banking, at the same time. And so it allows for like an efficient mechanism, if you will, for stabilizing broad sectors. And so in terms of the tool itself, it's probably the best mechanism that the Fed has in terms of stabilizing broad economic sectors. The question then becomes, is this creating moral hazard? Is this the proper use of funds? And then the other question, which I just wrote a paper on, which is, should be published in, you know, shortly, in the University of Pennsylvania Journal of Business Law, it touches on topics that you brought up in your recent article about, well, what's the regulatory response to this? You know, if we are getting a bailout, and if these intermediating asset managers are benefiting, like if the Fed is using ETFs to stabilize the economy, well, the asset manager who originates that ETF has a clear benefit from that support. So then the question goes is, do we need to review the regulatory parameters around these asset managers? Do we need to treat them as systemically important financial institutions? And, you know, as you know, the recent rules changes from the Financial Stability Oversight Council on systemically important non-banks, they moved from an entity-based assessment where you know, you look at a BlackRock and say, well, what is the, you know, importance of BlackRock and the interconnectedness of BlackRock and all these entity-based assessments, these have been rescinded. So we don't have any non-bank systemically important financial institutions right now. And then the rules have been changed. And the effect of the rules changing from assessing them institution by institution to now assessing what they do, so the activities, and looking at activities-based regulation, meaning if one of these entities is engaging in an activity that is potentially can negatively affect the financial system, well, then they're going to regulate that activity. We move from entity-based to activity-based. But the result of this, though, is that it's made it almost impossible for any of these extremely large asset managers to be systemically important based on the revised guidelines. And this is particularly important to note, we haven't talked about this and maybe we should, is in regards to not just a firm like BlackRock's ETF business, but also their Aladdin business. Because when you look at this Aladdin software, or it's not even a software, it's like a full-blown back office infrastructure that basically provides a end-to-end investment platform, comprehensive portfolio management, trading and operational tools to literally thousands and thousands of institutional clients. That through this risk management software, it you know, BlackRock has their assets under management that are coming up to $7 trillion, but the exposure of other asset managers who are influenced by their risk modeling software is in the neighborhood of $20 trillion. But when you actually look at the regulatory framework in assessing enhanced regulations, so like liquidity and capital rules and prudential regulation, the rules probably aren't going to capture these firms at all.
Why is that activity not systemically risky or important? Because just because it's so big and interconnected.
Here's where it gets tricky. Aladdin isn't actually the activity itself. Aladdin is the framework. It is other asset managers that are performing the activity. It's the other asset managers that are licensing this Aladdin mechanism to then manage their own affairs. So then the only potential activity that we are dealing with here is having a centralized influence. Now, I think that there's good arguments to say that this could become, you know, if not already is, systemically important. There's some significant economies of scale issue here in that the larger Aladdin becomes, the more data it is able to process, the more likely it is to gain more and more and more users of it. So the activity, though, isn't what BlackRock is actually performing. The activity is the other firms who are accessing the Aladdin system. Basically, in kind of summary fashion, we have a scenario now where we have probably the largest concentration of economic power in a private actor in history, even greater than anything prior to the financial crisis, in terms of the number of assets that are either managed by BlackRock or directly influenced by its system, including the influence that BlackRock even has on the government. But yet the current rules wouldn't likely make BlackRock systemically important.
Wow. Yeah, well, it seems to me it's systemically important from the point of view of the real productive economy. If you've got this monster machine, the Aladdin, mm-hmm. et cetera, that is advising everybody that's hooked into it what a good investment is or bad investment
is. That's right.
You know, they know both sides of the derivatives game, et cetera. So they're
yep.
playing the game and obviously have an edge. I mean, they have an insider's view of what's going on because they know all this other data. And then the rest of us, like the mom and pop shops, they aren't even corporations, so they're not even in the stock market. You know, they're not listed on the stock market, or the little companies in the stock market that aren't in the ETFs, they're getting discriminated against. You know, it's just basically not fair.
Yes, it seems like they're obviously systemically important. And the question is then, do the current rules that... Because when we say what does it mean to be systemically important, really what we're talking about is regulating non-banks like banks. So putting enhanced controls, capital and liquidity measures, stress testing on entities that don't function like banks. And that's been very controversial. I think it becomes more material when you start realizing that ETFs are being used like cash. And so they are actually, other institutions are holding ETFs on their balance sheets the same way they were holding money market mutual funds. And so then the question then becomes, if there are financial entities that are operating that benefit from Fed intervention, and they are putting into the economy cash-like instruments, should they then have regulatory parameters that are heightened, that are more akin to a bank? And this is a very controversial subject.
Yeah, well, that was a great explanation. Very complicated, but I got a lot out of it. So we're coming up to the end of our time here for this program, but thank you very much for explaining all that.
So, sure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for talking to us. I'll just spell your name in case anybody's looking you up. So it's RYANCLEMENTS with a T. Okay.
That's correct.
Bye. I've been speaking with Ryan Clements, Assistant Professor and Chair in Business Law and Regulation at the University of Calgary Faculty of Law.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money.